should be on slide 1 of the presentation. As explained on slide 2, the main page contains the slides above which you will find navigation icons. Internet participants may submit questions by using the question mark icon you see above the slide and need not wait until the question and answer period to submit a question. In fact, we encourage you to submit in advance of the question and answer session. Also, if you experience technical difficulties with the audio stream, you may use the question mark icon to alert us to the technical difficulties you are encountering. Please include a telephone number where you can be reached, and we will try to help you troubleshoot the problem. The presenters will be announcing the number of the slide to which they are moving. You may advance to the next slide using the single right arrow located above the slide or by clicking on the appropriate slide number in the left-hand frame. At the end of the presentation, we will walk you through our links page where we have assembled resources directly applicable to today's topic. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. Associated with the links page is an online feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form. We do look at your comments as we continue to try to improve the content and delivery mechanisms. We typically place these webinars in an archive with the soundtrack. In the near future, you will be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as it was given today. Past web seminars are available on the CLUIN website and are also accessible via iTunes by searching for Superfund Research Program, which will take you to the Hazardous Waste Cleanup Information or CLUIN archives and the new Superfund Research Program Research Brief podcast. With that, we are ready to start this session. Once more, I would like to remind phone participants to keep your phones on mute, and again, do not put us on hold. Our presenters for today, or for today's webinar, are William Sook, the director of the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences Superfund Research Program, Heather Henry, SRP Program Administrator, Beth Anderson, SRP Program Analyst, Lisa Edwards, NIEHS Grant Management Specialist, and Janice Allen, NIEHS Scientific Review Officer. I will now turn the time over to them.
Okay. Thank you, Justin. Appreciate it. We are now on slide 3, okay, just for you who are following along. Welcome to the Superfund Research Program Funding Opportunity Web Seminar. As Justin mentioned, I'm Bill Sook. I'm director of this program at NIEHS. I want to thank you for participating in this webinar. As it turns out, we have over 100 registrants, and therefore very pleased that there is so much interest in our program. In addition to the presenters, for your information, in addition to the presenters listed on the slide, we have a whole room full of people here from NIEHS here in Research Triangle Park who have put together a set of slides that will serve as an introduction to our program, its funding opportunities, and any other information that you hopefully will find useful and informative. Next slide. All right, here we go. You'll see in front of you the agenda for today's webinar. We're going to cover the Superfund Research Program mandates, give you an idea about the strategic plan, give you an idea about the different funding opportunities, the large multi-project centers program, the P42s, the R01 program, and our small business innovative research program. We will then have discussion about grants management, specifically the budget, the scientific review process, and then open it to questions and answers. We're going to spend about 1 hour to familiarize you with the SRP itself, our strategic plan, current funding opportunities, importantly in both terms of science, but also in terms of application and process. And all of this is reflected in the agenda. Next slide. Slide 5. What you should see before you is a slide that gives you the 4 mandates of the program. I'm not going to read all of these to you, just to let you know that the program was established as a university-based grants program In 1986, under the Superfund Amendments and Reauthorization Act, or SARA, our mandates are outlined, look at the human health effects, the risk assessment, detection, and remediation technologies, all to address issues associated with hazardous substances and their exposures and the reduction of risk from these exposures. All the funding mechanisms we'll be talking about today are consistent with these mandates. And I'm not going to read you these, but I give you them for your reference, and I urge you to look at them on a regular basis as you go through the process of submitting an application. Next slide, slide six. In 2010, we went through a strategic planning process. So in addition to our mandates, our program is guided by the strategic plan, and which is also available to you electronically on the web. The final plan stresses our continuing dedication to program relevance and identifies our key stakeholders as the Superfund programs at the US EPA and ATSDR, Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, as well as other entities responsible for sites impacted by hazardous substances and the communities living near these sites. We also highlight the importance of program research to achieve impact and promote innovation. We also look to be able to translate these research findings in a meaningful way to address the needs of EPA and ATSDR. So during today's presentation, I encourage you to consider how to design meritorious scientific studies that are relevant to key stakeholders that will make an impact on Superfund and will bring innovation to the practice of managing hazardous substances. Key to this is the, as I mentioned a second ago, is the importance of providing applications that are meritorious in their intent and in their design. And that is essentially the overall theme for the rest of the day, as staff here will begin to guide you through the entire process. And should you have any questions, there'll be obviously an answer, question answer period towards the latter part of the afternoon. At this point, I'm going to hand it over to Heather Henry, who will describe the Superfund Research Program's three funding mechanisms. Heather?
Thanks, Bill. Next slide is slide seven. I've noticed that some of you have made comments about the volume of our voices if we're loud enough, and you just continue to give us feedback if we're loud enough by hitting that the little question mark button, letting us know if you can hear us loud and clear. And we're going to go ahead and start with slide number seven, which shows the different funding mechanisms. We offer three funding mechanisms at this time, and I'll spend a little time on each of them. Briefly, they are the Small Business Innovative and Technology Transfer Research Grants, or SBIR-STTR grants, which fund innovative remediation and detection technologies as part of an ongoing funding opportunity open to U.S. small businesses. They utilize the NIH activity code, which is between the R41, R42s, R43s, and R44s. The SRP also periodically offers the individual research project grant, which addresses specific topics called for in request for applications, or RFAs. The activity code for that one is R01, which is one of the most common NIH funding mechanisms. Lastly, SRP's largest and mainstay funding opportunity is the Multi-Project Center Grant, or the P42. The multi-project structure allows for integration across disciplines, particularly between the biomedical and non-biomedical research disciplines. Per our program mandates, the R01 and the P42 research grants must be submitted through accredited U.S. universities. However, we've always encouraged applicants to collaborate with others from government, nonprofit organizations, for-profit organizations, and other academic institutions, including foreign. So let's move on to our first on slide 8, we'll start with the SBIR and STTR funding opportunities. Slide 9. There are two small business programs, the SBIR and the STTR. and they both promote technological innovation within small businesses, or essentially the private sector. The primary difference between the two are that the technology transfer grants, or the STTRs, have significant contributions from nonprofits, such as universities. And by contribution, I mean intellectual input or activities by university research. These grants are done in two phases. The first phase, phase one, establishes the technical feasibility of a technology, and after successful completion of a phase one, a phase two allows for further research and development, and requires the establishment of a commercialization plan. In cases where the phase one feasibility is kind of a given, like just an adaptation of a current technology for another application, that's just one example, a fast track application can be requested, which combines both phase one and phase two in one application. So I've listed the recommended cost and time ceilings for each permutation of the small business awards. And I just want to note, though, that SRP's congressionally mandated set aside for this type of research is just $1.4 million. So just to point out that the phase twos in particular are quite competitive. So let's move on to slide 10. SRP is interested in innovative remediation and detection technologies that can be useful for application in the hazardous waste scenarios that Superfund would be dealing with. We're particularly interested in the development of technologies with platforms that are more energy efficient or lead to reduced waste generation relative to existing monitoring and remediation technologies, so otherwise known as green and sustainable technologies. I just also want to mention that the rest of NIEHS also has an SBIR and STTR program that funds biomedical-related research. This would be, you know, maybe commercial development of maybe a biomarker or an exposure detection technology. And although I'm not the program contact for that, I'd be happy to put anybody in touch with anyone interested in that type of research. So the exact topics of interest will actually be released in January when they re-release the program announcement for the SBIR and STTR programs. But I've listed the current announcements, which is for 2010. And from these announcements, the links to the new announcement will be provided. And from there, you can find the exact topics of interest for NIEHS and Superfund. So there are three receipt dates, and once an application is received, it's processed through the Center of Scientific Review at NIH, and applications are reviewed in a standing SBIR-STTR study section. And Dr. Allen's going to speak a little bit later on and talk about the review and scoring processes in a few minutes. But I do want to note that in order to even submit an application, you must be registered within the NIH grant system through grants.gov and ERA Commons, which is the electronic grant processing system that NIH uses. this is true for all funding mechanisms, but we find that with small businesses, they don't necessarily have that registration already in place, whereas universities do tend to already have that registration in place. I do also want to remind folks that over the last year that research projects and applications, the descriptions or the research strategies, the length of pages allowed has dramatically decreased, as well as many other sections of the application. So I just want to, this applies to all applications today, but I just do want to mention that that has also impacted the SBIR and STTR. Okay, so moving on to the next slide, slide 11, I've listed the contact information for scientific topics. And that would be me for program. It's questions related to budget or ERA Commons registration. James Williams is the better contact for that. I also encourage you to call or email if you have questions. We realize this is a really quick overview, but we do want to move on to the other two funding mechanisms, the next one being on slide 12. So we're going to talk about the individual research project, which had a recent request for applications titled Innovative Bioavailability Assays to Assess the Effectiveness of Contaminated Sediment Remediation. Next slide, 13. The purpose of this RFA is to stimulate interest in bioavailability assays that can be applied to determine how well a sediment remediation approach has reduced risks to humans. So ultimately, our goal is twofold. One is to introduce new tools to assess remediation effectiveness, and secondly, And we'd really like to see an increase in the confidence in using bioavailability and risk assessment. We think this is very important, and our program has promoted it in many different ways. So I just want to highlight a subtlety here, why we're focusing on remediation scenarios. And the reason is we'd like for tools that are useful for more than just initial site assessment or risk characterization, which some, you know, assays are often used for. But we really want these assays to target downstream effects that, you know, can also indicate whether there's been a reduction in risk to humans accomplished, you know, as a result of or in conjunction with a remediation application. So next slide, please. Slide 14. This slide reiterates some of the measures of bioavailability that we feel would be within the scope of the program. This also appears in the RFA. And these are just suggestions. We welcome you to contact us separately if you have specific questions. I do want to point out that the RFA does have a multidisciplinary aspect to it. We'd like to see researchers assemble the appropriate expertise to consider this question holistically. So in addition to bioassay development, we do expect applicants to demonstrate an understanding of the remediation technology itself and, you know, helpful to include, you know, investigators who help develop such remediation technologies, but also bioavailability mechanisms. And we also want to see crossovers into, you know, scientists providing an indication of how they think that the data generated can be useful for assessment for risk on sites or even risk management. I also want to mention that we're interested in teams looking at assays applicable to innovative remediation technologies as well as more mainstream sediment contamination remediation technologies. So next slide, please. Slide 14. Here's information about the RFA announcement and due dates. There are letters of intent are due January 18th. Now, these letters include the name of the PI and other key personnel and a title of the research project. They're not required, but they do help us plan the review, and they can also help us identify potential issues of responsiveness prior to the actual receipt date. So these letters go to the scientific review officer, who would be Dr. Sally Eckert-Talad, who's in the room right now, and we have her contact information on the next slide. There is a cost limitation of $200,000 direct cost for each year, and that's up to 3 years. The RFA mentions that approximately 5 to 6 awards will be made, and this is always going to be subject to the availability of funds and sufficient number of meritorious applications. So again, Dr. Eckert-Talad will organize the review of these applications. It'll be under a special emphasis panel. And I encourage applicants to carefully look at their review criteria. I've provided a direct link here. Again, more details on the review and the NIH scoring process will be discussed by Dr. Allen in just a few minutes. Next slide. Here are the contact details. It's kind of scratched up a little bit, and we did that on purpose. So there was a change in grants management assignment after we published the RFA. So Barbara Gittleman is now the contact person, although Lisa Edwards and Michelle Victolino, their names appear on the RFA, and I'm sure anyone who contacts them, they will be happy to forward you to the right person, who would be Barbara. So again, Dr. Eckert-Talad will be the review contact person, and since she's here in the room, if you do have questions specifically for her, she's here to answer those. Now, at this time, let's go on to the next slide, number 17, to talk about the multi-project centers. So we tend to refer, so you notice the first ones were independent research projects, and that's kind of in comparison to these being the multi-project centers. So we refer to these as the P42s, which is a unique mechanism assigned to the Superfund Hazardous Substance Research and Training Program. The next slide. We're on slide 18. The goal of the P42 centers ultimately is to improve public health through integrative research. And we want to provide sound science to inform the ongoing risk assessment remediation management activities that occur at the numerous hazardous waste sites across the country. So our hope is to bring the expertise of health and environmental researchers to address some of these issues, these real intractable issues that are being faced by, you know, sites like Superfund sites. So next slide, slide 19. The P42 concept is essentially a problem-solving network whereby a collection of health and environmental researchers interact to address the critical questions related to health effects, risk detection, and remediation of hazardous substances. So this comes directly from our mandate, you might recall, from what Dr. Sook was telling us at the beginning. So in addition to the biomedical and non-biomedical research, there's also an emphasis on research translation, which is delivering science to the end users, and in a nutshell, and engagement of impacted communities. We also include multidisciplinary training of the next generation of environmental health scientists. So the next slide on 19 shows a diagram of kind of what we mean by this concept. So starting with the center area of the grant, we expect applicants to interact with stakeholders and or impacted communities to identify key issues in need of mechanistic research. So new to this RFA and in response to our strategic plan, we do ask that applicants craft their scientific inquiry, you know, so that you're going to result in data or information that leads our stakeholder groups towards a solution that would improve health outcomes or reduce the risk or uncertainty of exposure or improve site assessment or remediation practices. Next slide, please. The scope of the centers derives from our broad mandates, which are listed again here in orange. We've always stressed relevance to the National Superfund program, which is managed by our Superfund agencies at the U.S. EPA and at the ATSDR. But, you know, new kind of as a result of our strategic plan, this RFA also targets relevance to our sister fund. Well, it targets relevance, and we highlight, you know, our stakeholders as being those from our sister Superfund program at EPA and ATSDR. But also our key stakeholders would be from other agencies involved in the assessment and management of hazardous substances, which, you know, might be from federal, state, local, and tribal entities. We're also very much interested in engaging communities that are living near these sites and impacted by these hazardous substances. So also mentioned in our strategic plan is our interest in transdisciplinary research and a forward-looking or paradigm-challenging research. This is kind of our way of achieving innovation in research. So given these guiding principles, we really see a lot of latitude in how applicants can assemble their research centers and what they choose to study. We do, however, provide for inspiration a list of topics on our website, and the link is provided here. And, you know, a lot of these topics came from real intense interactions with our colleagues at the U.S. EPA and the ATSDR. So we do feel that this list reflects what they see as some of their needs. But we encourage you to make that exploration yourself. Next slide. So, we get this question a lot about what hazardous substances are included in the program, and so I've included here what is listed in the RFA. Certainly drivers of risk at hazardous waste sites would be highly relevant to the program. We also do have a place for emerging contaminants or emerging concerns, but we do want to see that these are linked to Superfund relevancy, and the RFA states that, you know, to demonstrate how the results gained from those studies would be relevant to Superfund or lead to better decision-making for risk assessors and remediation managers at Superfund sites. So we also list some ideas about what we're interested in terms of emerging contaminants. And next slide, slide 23, shows all the components of a P42 multi-project center. And as you can imagine, it's quite large, and it takes quite a while to assemble a fully functional team. But we'll tell you what the components are. You know, and this is meant to cover the broad mandates of our program. So on the left, in green and lavender, are, you know, represented by the research projects. We require a minimum of 2 biomedical and 2 non-biomedical research projects, as well as an administrative core, a research support core, a research translation core and a community engagement core. The training cores are not required but are highly encouraged as a way to achieve full integration and cross-disciplinary activities. We'll note that new proposals can propose up to $1.8 million in direct costs for up to 4 years, and renewal proposals are for up to 5 years, and there's a 3% kind of inflation that can be added to their final year of funding, which is described in the RFA. So the next slide, 24, I'm going to talk about the research projects themselves. So each research project is really meant to be a standalone project, expected to have independent testable hypotheses, or if it happens to be more application-based, it might have a very logical progression of tasks. So while each project is standalone, there is a requirement for a degree of interconnectivity between projects. So, you know, at a minimum, that would be the theme or the problem that the whole center is addressing or set of problems that the center is addressing. But we do, really value seeing researchers thinking about how their research aims, their specific aims link with one another between projects. Also, we commonly see interactions in terms of sharing of specimens and data, using data from one project to help inform another project. So, in our definition of biomedical, these research projects address the human health-related implications of hazardous substances. So we kind of, in the RFA, suggested that this would be mechanistic-based toxicology studies, human risk assessment, epidemiology, genetic susceptibility, computational toxicology, biomedical engineering, those types of research. And for non-biomedical, we're more thinking about sort of the environmental science or engineering implications of hazardous substances. So that type of inquiry would be more engineering or geology, ecology, microbiology, fate and transport, hydrogeology, remediation, and detection sciences. And, of course, this is in the RFA. So next slide, slide 25, I'm going to talk about the administrative core. This is kind of the executive branch of the program. It provides structure to the multi-project grants and is responsible for ensuring integration between projects and cores, effective translation of the outcomes of the program, and fiscal management as well as quality management. And, another big part of the administrative core, very important, is the assembly of the external advisory committee, which for new applicants might be more of a plan or who you might include, but for other applicants, for returning applicants, this group should be providing guidance to the director about the merit of the research, the relevance and importance of the center components, how effective the integration and translation and community engagement and training activities have been. And, anticipated members might be academics, stakeholders, folks from EPA, HESDR, also industry and certainly community members are good candidates for an external advisory committee. Next slide, 26. The research support cores, as named, they support a particular research function are shared between at least two projects. Might be analytical work or data analysis or could be more technology-driven. Provide centralized services, and hopefully there's a kind of an economic benefit for having two or three projects working with one centralized core. And we do ask that researchers or that applicants delineate that in their application. The training core promotes graduate-level cross-disciplinary training. And although the training cores are optional, we do really highly value this component because the cross-training of graduate students is really an excellent way to achieve linkages and integration between projects and cores. And, another thing that came out of our strategic plan was getting the trainees involved in research translation and community engagement. And part of that, again, is learning how to communicate their science effectively. So we really highly value training core and see how it can really help support many of the goals of the program. I do want to mention also that the Training Corps, it does have a 6% budget limit, and the budget could include Corps leader and staff, expenses associated with the Corps, as well as student support. So, slide 27. I'm going to pass this off to Beth Anderson, who has been the lead in the research translation and community engagement.
Thank you, Heather. And as you mentioned before, Heather, did you say if you can't hear me, there's a signal they can use to keep, let us know? We're working from one phone in this room, so. Okay. Heather has already given you a little bit of background or information on the Research Translation Corps. I will state up front, I'm sure everyone knows that this is a required corps for each application. The goal is for you to determine, is that right? The goal is for you to determine how best to advance the science coming out of your center. This will likely be achieved through multiple mechanisms such as dissemination, communication, partnering, maybe formal technology transfer arrangements. But again, you do what you need to do to accomplish these four elements or the four components that are listed on the slide. I also want to note that we use research translation a little differently than NIH. This is not about clinical translation. So on the next slide, 28, could you advance that? Oh, you got it. Sorry. Okay, thank you. She did. Sorry. So what's the biggest change for those of you who have been tracking these RFAs the last couple of years? What's the biggest change to this research translation? Well, backing up 1 year, last year in our RFA, we required the inclusion of communicating to NIEHS and other Superfund research programs. I think this is self-explanatory. We want to know what you are up to. What is new in this RFA is that it explicitly states that we expect translation to be built into each project. We expect coordination between the projects and the research translation corps. This is to say that translation is not solely and independently the corps is not solely and independently responsible for translation. Another thing that is new this year is that what we formerly called communicating to broad audiences is now information dissemination to other end users. This change was instituted to more clearly distinguish this activity from community engagement. Anyway, the idea for this core is that your translation is initiated based on the advances in your center. In practice, you'll be most successful if you are interactive with your target audiences. But efforts should be driven by the science. So this is not necessarily a bidirectional activity. And on slide 29, we'll move into a little discussion on community engagement and our expectations there. This is, what's new this year is that this is now a required component. It supports a community need that's developed in conjunction with the community. The emphasis is the bidirectional nature of the activities. Both the academics and the community are to be involved throughout, and both should benefit from the partnership. On slide 30, yes, thank you. On this slide, we've identified some possible objectives or examples, types of activities that you may consider. I think we see one challenge that you may find is the need to be responsive to the community's needs while adhering to the theme of the center. This is one reason you might want to include other entities that are working directly with the community so as to assist you in aligning what the needs are with the theme of your center. Sometimes this partnership will help facilitate coordinating the interaction with the community and obtaining the goals of meeting the community's needs while fitting with your, the theme of your program. And then on slide 31, we have, wanted to talk a little bit about research translation versus the community engagement core, because it seems like one possible point of confusion is in our ability to articulate the difference between the information dissemination to other end users component of the research translation core and what our expectations are with a community engagement core. So first, the research translation core, the impetus for this activity is generated by the products of the center. You have something you want people to know about. You might want to work with them in developing the best way to convey this information, but you're in the driver's seat. Whereas with community engagement, the design and activity is developed jointly by the center and the partner or the community. The community is involved every step of the way. In other words, the research translation core can initiate from a unidirectional point, but the community engagement core must be developed jointly. Another point is point of difference is that it's likely that there will be multiple activities for each research translation core of different scales and size and in time frames. The core needs to be nimble and able to adjust with the need and the science coming out of the program, whereas it's more likely that the center activities will build around a few strong themes and work with the community on these specific themes. Well, of course, it has to fit within the theme of the program, but the activities will build around a few central points. So just to wrap up these two sections on the Research Translation Core and Community Engagement Core, I think that if you're familiar with the program over time, you've seen an evolution in these areas. But the bottom line is that the SRP remains a basic research program that is more than just research now. We're over 20 years old. We're committed to being accountable, and a major way we envision achieving this is through our research translation and community engagement cores. These are vital to the program, and that's why they're required. And I'll turn this back to Heather.
Okay, great. And we'll move on to slide 32. Is my count? Yeah, that looks right. Okay. And we just really want to, again, emphasize the multidisciplinary and interdisciplinary nature of the center. And, you know, this is lifted directly from the RFA under the review criteria. And I think I provide a link later. But in any case, we just want to stress that, you know, it's important that it's clear to the reviewers on how projects are integrated and what the plans for interdisciplinary interactions are. We really feel that this is the way to achieve real headway on some of the critical issues that are being considered by Superfund sites and those who manage and have to deal with hazardous substances. So we're also looking for coordination, synergy, and in particular, and this is challenging, but interactions between the health and the non-health research. So these are things that reviewers will be looking for. And I just put off to the side just a little application tip. You know, there are a couple opportunities for you to highlight these interactions within the application. And the section number two, extensive application guidelines for this grant, and we apologize for how complex it is, but we do provide information about that. That's just an aside. The center introduction is the second part of the application, and that gives you an opportunity to explain the interactions between the different projects and cores. But then there's also a one page that precedes each project and core, which is about its relation to the overall center. So these are opportunities for you to highlight interactions between projects. And in doing so, the next point or application tip we wanted to make was that you need to make sure that you cross-reference these interactions. So if one project identifies, Project 1 identifies Project 7 as one of their buddies and somebody they're interacting with, and it's really good if Project 7 also identifies Project 1 as one of their buddies and somebody they're interacting with. I'm saying buddy as vernacular, obviously I don't mean that, but there's a scientific linkage. And so it's just very important that you're consistent throughout the entire application, and it's, you know, always great to just have somebody with fresh eyes looking through and looking for those consistencies when you put together your application. So the next page, or next slide, is 33. And we just wanted to make sure that we highlight these new features. New to this RFA, which Beth has mentioned, is that community engagement is a requirement. But we also, you know, just wanted to say a little something about community engagement projects, which we're kind of calling CEPs. You know, they're explicitly mentioned in the RFA this year. However, you know, it has always been welcome for as a project, as a research project for an investigator to choose to make that a community-based participatory research project. And we feel that this can be biomedical or non-biomedical depending on, you know, the interests of the community. If their interests are more in line with some sort of non-biomedical or fate and transport type of activity, it might actually be a non-biomedical community-based participatory research project. So in letting you know about this, I would be remiss if I didn't mention that there is another section in the application. It's called the Community Engagement Component Statement. And this is an opportunity for all community engagement cores, but also for any community engagement project to really, really have an opportunity to talk about what their approaches are for achieving bidirectional communication between the community and the researchers or the core leaders, as the case would be. So another new thing to this RFA is that new applicants may request up to 4 years. Before it was up to 5 years. And then there have been lots of recent changes. One which Beth and I think Dr. Stook also mentioned is Research Translation Corps, that there's now a plan required for each project to have an opportunity to translate the findings. We also wanted to mention that the page limitations have changed, the review scoring system has changed, and that now there's only one resubmission allowed within the NIH grant system. And so, these are not new to this RFA, but it has happened in the last few years. And then we do just really want to talk about what hasn't changed with the program. And this is a question that we get a lot. Is it for site-specific? And we certainly have included a lot of that wording in the RFA and the strategic plan, but we do want to make sure that people understand that we're not a site-specific program. There's not a requirement to work on a Superfund site or for your site interactions or the type of research that you do to be directly on a Superfund site. So that has not changed out of our program. We are still not a site-specific program. Also, we've always been basic research. We are, you know, our congressional name is Superfund Basic Hazardous Substances Center. But, you know, we are also application-oriented research is welcome within the framework of these centers. And, of course, very much unchanged is that we do welcome innovative approaches to research. So at this point, turn, please, to slide 34. And here's a link to the announcement and the application details. Another point is that only one application is allowed per institution. Letters of intent are due on March 16th. Again, these are not required, and I believe Dr. Allen will say a little bit more about that later. The due date for the application is April 15th. And the scientific review is expected to be about October, with awards starting next, not this coming April, but April 2012. And again, I mentioned there are real extensive application guidelines. It's a very different type of application. It's a paper application, in fact. And we've provided a link here that will walk you through all the different sections of the RFA. And just want to encourage staff consultation. We'll have a list of all of the people that you can contact if you have any questions, and we just highly recommend touching base with us here at NIEHS and, letting us answer your questions and really think about your centers as you're putting them together. And that's either in person or through teleconference, however we can get together. And I also have notes here to mention that the RFA, mentions that approximately $10 million will be devoted to this program to fund about 3 or 4 grants. And again, that depends on money and the number of meritorious applications. So slide 35 just kind of reiterates our mandates and who our stakeholders are, as well as another link to the suggested research topics. And slide 36, again, talks about the hazardous substances that we're interested in. And slide 37 is meant to be a resource page for you. This is a screenshot of our SRP multi-project program grant webpage. And anything that comes up, any links that we think will be useful for people who are undergoing this process of putting together a center, we will post on this webpage. So we do ask that if you have interest that you would bookmark this page. And we also encourage you to utilize the SRP website to see what other centers are doing. And because the outreach and translation course can be very new explorations for many university researchers, we also encourage you to have a look at the outreach and translation course. There's a page that has a link to just the course from each program, and that can be helpful to see what other centers are doing. Page 38 list the program contacts, and you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different program administrators to talk to about putting together a center. Our grants management officers are Lisa Edwards and Michelle Victolino, and they're both in the room here now, and we'll be hearing from Lisa in just a minute. And a scientific review for this round will be Dr. Janice Allen, and you'll hear from her after Lisa. So at this point, I'm just going to pass it off to Ms. Edwards to talk about grants.
Thank you, Heather. We're going to just briefly talk about budget preparation, and this is not meant to be in-depth at all, so it's going to be brief, and if you have any questions after this, feel free to email Michelle or either myself to discuss it or either give us a call. And I thank Heather for doing that. We're going to move along to slide 40. For the P42s, please be reminded that they are still paper copies. You will have to use the latest version of the 398. The R01s and the SBRs and the STTRs are done with the electronic version of the SF424, which also makes sure that you're using the most updated one. The electronic version changes often, so before you submit your grant, please make sure that you are using the correct form. I don't think it will go through if you're not using the correct one. Also, we just encourage you now, if you're planning to submit a grant when you do, please get your ICOC and your IRB approvals in process. Get those things started. They will hold up an award being issued at a later date. So if you start them, by the time an award is issued, hopefully you'll have it would have gone through the whole process. Other support is also an item that we usually have issues with. We cannot accept zero, varies, or as needed. It has to be an accurate number, and we are now using calendar months. So you cannot have anything that's over 12 calendar months or anything that's less than 0 months. So please make sure when you're doing your other support, and it has to be active, not past support, but current active support. And we also encourage you to list the P42 grant and your amount of effort that you plan to put on that grant in the other support, so that way you have an accurate view of everything that you're actually going to be on. We have people that leave that off. And then they'll come in, and then once the P42 effort is added, they're either over. And so to keep from this from happening, it's a good thing to always use that P42 or list that P42 either as pending or, since it's not current, that's the only thing you can list as, but it's good to include it in your other support. So we're going to move along to slide 41. Continuing with the budget preparation, remember for your direct cost totals that your F&A amount for subawards is not included in the cap for your total direct cost. So if you're capped at the $1.8 million, if you have any F&A that's for a subcontract, the F&A is not included when you're determining that $1.8 million. Though that figure will be added later, and we'll take care of that if you list it correctly on your budget page, which you'll see a sample of that later. It'll all add up. It doesn't look like it sometimes, and people often wonder on that first page, on your face page, when you list the amount, they want to include all of it, and they think if they do include all of it, then they'll be excluded from meeting the cap, but that's not true. Please also remember that you do have to have budget pages for all of your subs. We stress this because we often see budgets that will list that they have a sub and then there's no budget pages. We also need to have contact information. I encourage grantees to submit a face page for their sub awards. That way all of the pertinent information that we need before we can issue an award is already there.
Someone has asked, what is FNA?
F&A is your facilities and administrative costs. It's the overhead. Indirect costs, also costs. And I apologize for not spelling that out on the slide. Okay, we're moving along to slide 42. Again, I'm going to stress about subawards. They should be listed directly behind your project or core that the work is being done for. Don't put all the subawards together. If there's a sub on Project 1, list it directly behind Project 1. If you have a subcontract that is doing work for Project 1 and Core A, list it with Project 1, and then you need to list budget pages for the Core A as well. We also would like to stress that you need, for the P42s, is using a non-modular budget form. We have copies of those samples of those later in the presentation. You need to have budget pages for each project and for each core, as well as all of your sub-awards or your third party. The R1s and the R1s are using a non-modular budget, or because they are modular grants. They are using a modular budget form. The SBRs, STTRs are using the full categorical budget that's listed in the FF424. Also remember that if you're escalating anything over than 3% in any of your out years, it must be justified, even if it's personnel. And if your personnel is going up in any of the out years, please list the amount of effort it's going up by or that it's being decreased by, because we can't calculate that, and we don't always know what formulas you're using to get to your next salary level. Also, travel to the annual meeting. This is a requirement. You need to make sure that funds are included so that your business, your PI, the business manager, and four students have travel funds to attend the annual meetings each year. We also expect the core leaders from your community engagement and your research translation core to also be present. And there will be, at a later time, or if you're make the cut, and the progress reports that we do expect to see some detailed information about who actually attended the meeting, so we do sort of keep track of that. So now we are moving to just a copy or a sample of what the composite budget could look like, depending on how many cores and how many projects you have. Please note at the bottom how the subaward amounts are listed here on this composite page, but they would still be listed individually as a project, and you'll see that later. Also, please note that this version actually was released 11/07. It is an older version. Please make sure that you are using the current one. The important things here that I'll just highlight here are your direct costs. Your subtotal direct costs includes the direct costs of all of your consortiums. Your total direct cost actually includes the direct cost and your F&A or your indirect for your subs. So various bases for all of the information if it's listed correctly. Moving to slide 44. This is showing the composite budget for all four years. I'll also stress again here, we often see that there has been an escalation in these out years for greater than 3%. If there is nothing in the justification as to why the escalation is greater than 3%, we could only restrict you to 3%. But if it's greater than 3% and you have justified it, more than likely we can give it to you. So we are moving along to slide 45. Excuse me, this is just a copy of an individual budget page, and this is the page that you should have for each project, each core, and each sub. Also note that, which I didn't mention on the previous pages, but at the top left-hand corner, you see project one. We would like to have all the budget pages numbered or named at the top so that they can be clearly identified by your grants management specialist, as well as your reviewers. Thank you so much for your time, and I'm going to pass this along now to Janice Allen, who is the scientific reviewer.
Thank you, Lisa. I'm Janice Allen, excuse me, and I will be convening the 2011 P42 Superfund Review Meeting. Dr. Eckert-Tolata, who's also present in the room, and who held the 2010 P42 Review Meeting, will conduct the 2011 R01 review meeting, which Dr. Henry talked about earlier. We'll both be happy to answer any review-related questions either here at the meeting today or at a later time. Dr. Henry has given you details about the R01 and an SBIR-STTR mechanisms, and I want to briefly describe the review process. Applicants are not... this is slide 47. Applicants are not required to submit letters of intent for the SBIR-STTR mechanisms, but LOIs, or letters of intent, will be accepted for the R01 applications. They're not required, they're not binding, and are not considered in the review process. However, they do serve to assist NIEHS staff to begin planning for the review and the workload. Information to be included in the LOI is given in the RFA and was given also by Dr. Henry earlier. Both the SBIR, STTR, and R01 applications are submitted electronically to grants.gov. The SBIR, STTR applications are assigned to a CSR, or Center for Scientific Review, standing study section. If needed, ad hoc reviewers are called upon to review special expertise not provided by the regular study section members. Now, for the R01 applications, they will be reviewed in a special emphasis panel here at NIEHS, and reviewers will be recruited with the specific expertise needed to evaluate those applications. Specific review criterion are provided in the RFA, so please note the provided web links on this slide. Slide 48. A new aspect of peer review for NIH is the scoring of the above listed 5 individual criteria based on a scale of 1 to 9, with 1 being the best score. In addition, for the SBIR, STTR, and R01 applications, reviewers will provide an overall impact priority score, which, again, is the 1 to 9 score, to reflect their assessment of the likelihood for the project to exert a sustained, powerful influence on the research fields involved, which is based on these 5 review criteria and based on additional review criteria. Additional review considerations will not receive scores or be considered in the overall priority score. applications deemed to have the highest scientific and technical merit, generally the top half of the applications under review, will be discussed and therefore assigned an overall impact or priority score. Both discussed and streamlined or non-discussed applications will receive a written critique. As shown on the next slide, the P42 process has similarity to the SBIR-STTR-001 process, but it is a bit more complicated. So I'll spend a few slides walking you through the whole process. All of this information is provided in the SRP RFA, and briefly, letters of intent are due mid-March and applications due April 15th, 2011. I think it's a little ironic that they're due on tax day, but double stress for everybody, I guess. Approximately 4 weeks later, an administrative review will be held by NIEHS staff to determine responsiveness of the applications. Applicants of non-responsive applications will be notified immediately by the Superfund program staff. The responsive applications will then move through the review process. Reviewers with appropriate expertise will be recruited and sent applications for which they are not in conflict with to evaluate. The review meeting will be held in late October or early November, and whether applications are discussed or not discussed will be determined at the review meeting. As mentioned in the SBIR, STTR, and R1 overview, applications not discussed will receive criterion scores and a written critique. Applications discussed by the review committee will receive the criterion scores, a written critique, which will reflect comments made by the entire review committee, and an overall impact score. The second level of review by the National Advisory EHS Council will occur around February, and funding decisions and awards will be made around April of 2012. As you can see in the next slide, P42 applications are very diverse in scientific scope. The expertise shown here reflects the depth and diversity of the research, which is needed by reviewers to appropriately evaluate the applications. Did I skip a slide? Okay, now on slide 52, specifics for the review of the Superfund P42 applications are well kept, well described in the RFA. The initial review for scientific and technical merit will emphasize two major aspects: review of the projects and cores, and then review of the overall center. The overall impact of the Superfund Center application, in other words, the multi-project grant as an integrated research effort of project and support cores, is focused on a problem-based, solution-oriented theme. Reviewers will provide an overall impact priority score in consideration of the five scored review criteria, which is significance, investigators, innovation, approach, and environment, as well as the following additional review criteria: multidisciplinary and interdisciplinary nature of the center, integration and interaction of non-health-related research with health-based research, scientific merit of research projects, importance and use of cores, effective administration and translational cores, strengths of community outreach and training plans, director and other key personnel, and if it's an amended application, response to the previous review, and if it's a competitive renewal, the accomplishments that were achieved during the last funded period. Next, the overall impact of the research projects and cores is the review of each research project, research support core, and other core components independently. Reviewers will provide an overall impact or priority score in consideration of the five scored review criteria, and additional review criteria, such as protections for human subjects, vertebrate animals, inclusion plans, and biohazards, and the project or core's contribution to the overall Superfund Center. There are additional review elements for community engagement cores and projects and for renewal applications. Some cores, such as the administrative research, the research support, research translation, and training, have additional review criteria specific to those cores. For more comprehensive explanation of the review elements, please refer to the RFA. Now, slide 53. So to reiterate, each project and core will receive an impact score. This impact score, which is from 1 to 9, should take into account, again, the NIH's 5 review criteria, and the score should also take into account SRP criteria specified in the RFA, such as contribution to the goals of the overall center. For renewals, reviewers will evaluate whether previous specific aims have been accomplished and whether the new research goals are logical extensions of the ongoing work. All reviewers present in the room at the review meeting will give a score. So in the next slide, we'll talk more about the overall center impact score. Once all the projects and cores have been reviewed, there is a discussion of the overall impact score. This score is really the main score of the center. Taken into account for this overall impact score is the quality of the projects and cores for which the project impact scores would be an indication, as well as the integration between projects and scores. Also to consider is how the center as a whole interacts to move science forward. An application does not need to be strong in all areas to be judged likely to have a major scientific impact and a high priority score. In assessing the application, equal weighting may not be given to all the criteria. Instead, reviewers will weigh each of them as appropriate for each application. As I said earlier, all reviewers present will give a score, and the average of these scores multiplied by 10 becomes the final score of the center. On the next slide, I just want to say for all, let's see, on the next slide, I want to say for all applications, and that is the R01s, the FBIR, STTRs, and P42, applicants should follow good grantsmanship tips, such as seeking appropriate advice, be complete but concise, and importantly, don't assume the reviewers will know what you mean. You really need to be sure that you spell everything out, and presentation is very important as well. Specifically for the P42 applications, applicants should highlight the multidisciplinary, synergy, innovativeness, etc. of the center, and explain how it all fits together as a center. Weak projects should be excluded. So, again, this is where having a fresh set of eyes, your colleagues who are successful grant writers will be able to really look over your application and provide important recommendations. And those eyes don't need to be Superfund-funded people. A good grants reviewer or grants writer will be able to follow along, and you really need to, it's just advisable that you seek that kind of advice. So on the next slide, I just want to give a final note. This is a busy slide, but I've included specific guide notices to alert you to new changes affecting application submissions as of January 25th. Once an application has been submitted through grants.gov, NIH no longer provides applicants a 2-day error correction window to correct any identified errors or warnings before the final assembled application is created in ERA Commons. Plan to submit at least 1 week early so that all errors can be corrected by the deadline listed in the RFA, which is 5 o'clock, April 15th, 2011. I want you to know that if you can't see, when you go into Commons and you can't see the application as a whole, that means we can't see it as well. So if when you're checking every hour or, you know, at least daily, and I know most of you are probably checking every hour, if there are problems, you know, call the help desk or contact someone and keep a paper trail of those either emails back and forth or phone calls, because this is a lot of work, and if it's something happens, you just want to be able to follow up, and we want to review your great work or your potential work. Other changes, which I've listed the guide notices for, include post-submission application materials, the new time limits for resubmission, use of restructured application forms, such as now it's Adobe Forms V1, and I've listed guidance concerning appendix materials. Again, all of this information is available, a lot of it's available in that I've gone over today in the RFA, but Sally and I are very, well, for P42, I'd welcome any concerns or questions that you have, and somewhere, well, in the RFA, my contact information is listed, and of course, Dr. Talata, Eckhart Talata will be glad to answer any questions for the R01 that will be upcoming. So now I want to turn it back to Dr. Henry for her concluding
remarks. Yes, 5-7 is a quote. I'm not going to take credit for it. These are five that were at least Janice and Claudia Thompson passed on to me, but we wanted to include it. You know, components of a successful application, good idea, good science, but also it's very important it's a good application. So hopefully today's talk has helped you understand how you can hedge your bets, so to speak. So slide 58, we just wanted to acknowledge the SRP staff, grants management and scientific review staff from NIEHS for assistance in putting together this webinar, as well as Michael Adam, who's our contact at EPA, the EPA Cluin organization, and Justin, who is busily moderating the session behind the scenes. So at this point, slide 59, give some instructions for asking questions. We do have time for questions, and if you're interested in asking a question, if you're connected via the phone, you can press *6, and that will unmute your phone line. And then after you can state your name and organization and ask your question. To go back to muting your phone line, you just hit *6 again. And if you happen to be joining us via the internet, you can click on the question mark icon that appears in the upper right corner of the screen, and you'll have an opportunity to write in your question. I believe you hit enter or something like that, submit, and then within 30 seconds or so, it will appear on our screen. And I do want to let you know that we do have, you know, a number of questions pending, which we'll get to, and we appreciate that. And it's also an indication that the little question mark button is working so far. But we may not have enough time for answering all of the questions. We'll certainly make our best effort to do so. But we will answer these offline. If they seem to be kind of specific to you or to your program, we'll just answer you privately. Otherwise, anything that's general, we'll post on the web seminar webpage, which I've provided in this insert. It'll also be linked to from the Cluin website, which would have been sent to you from Gene Ballant, at least today or in the last couple of days. And do want to let you know that there will be an audio archive of this entire seminar. So we expect that it will be available in about 4 weeks, and it will be accessible from the above websites. So at this time, I'd like for those of you on the phone to think about questions that you want to ask. And what I'll do is I'll turn to Beth, if it's okay, to answer a couple of questions that have come up through our online participants. And that way we can start making headway on some of the questions that came in. And actually, Beth gave me a scared look, so.
No, I'm fine.
I didn't know if we were taking questions on the phone, but let's start with a few here. And Okay, so one question from Mitch Barrett is, what is a community? Should we propose a project linked to a specific Superfund site, group of regional sites, or a general project? So we would, as Heather said earlier, this is not a site-specific program, and so even in our community engagement cores, they are not site-specific. So it's perfectly fine if you are working with us at a Superfund site or any other hazardous waste site. You should just be certain that you include in your application a good, complete description of who your community partner is. And so working at NPL sites, working at state sites, those are fine, but you are not restricted to those. So hope that helped. There's another question from Mary Dereski. What are the thoughts about community actually collecting research data in the field? Well, I want to point out that this is not a community-based research project. The community engagement cores are not research projects, but it is appropriate to be working with the community if they are collecting data. It might be monitoring or screening. But if you're created a more hypothesis-driven research plan with your community, then that would be a project, not a research core.
Another question that we got was whether training can be master's and PhD level, and I do believe that is a P42 question, and the answer is yes, trainees can be master's and PhD level, as well as postdocs, who we consider to be trainees.
Let's see if there's somebody on the phone.
Oh, right. So at this time, let's see if anybody on the phone line has a question to ask. To do so, just press star and mute, and state your name and ask your question. Oh, sorry. God. Star 6, thank you. And state your name and organization, and go ahead and ask your question. Okay, while we're waiting for the phone participants to think about their question, I'm going to offer...
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead and ask your question.
Yeah, this is Oliver Hankinson at UCLA.
Hi there.
Hi. So can you decide to exclude one or more projects if, for example, there are 4 scientific projects and 3 non-biomedical projects, and the reviewers like 3 of the 4 scientific projects? Can they then exclude one of them and, say, give a higher score? Or at some point during the review process, can you basically pick and choose certain projects?
No.
This is Claudia Thompson.
The short answer is no.
Reviewers really judge based on what was submitted. We don't really encourage that they rewrite the proposal by excluding individual projects to, quote, improve the score of the overall program.
Okay, thank you.
But a project could be not... What? Not recommended for further consideration. And the application is still viable if you have the 2 biomedical and 2 non-biomedical. So if one gets knocked out and you've got those 2 and 2 covered, you're still a viable program.
So I guess that seems to be contradictory from what I've just heard.
No, it's not.
So this is Claudia again. So the review committee always has that option. If they see a project is so scientifically flawed that it should never see the light of day, they can give it a score of not recommended for further consideration. I would say in the last 3 to 4 years of review, reviewers have been have not done that because they feel that if a applicant puts in a really poor project, it reflects on the principal investigator, and they don't actually feel like rewarding the program by removing it and not considering it. So what has happened really is that really poor projects get scored, and the overall program can suffer because of that.
Okay, thank you.
Are there any other questions from the phone line?
I can't exclude.
And we continue to get, I'm just going to, since there haven't been any responses on the phone, we are getting quite a few questions online, and we'll start with kind of the more general ones that apply to other, to everyone, going to be of general interest. I wanted to answer one real quickly about the R01 program that, I need to find it again. What is the current funding percentile for the R01 and NIEHS? And, you know, although NIEHS would have a published R01 funding percentile, because this R01 goes to a special emphasis panel, there will not be a percentile calculation for this RFA. So that was a question from University of Michigan. And we also got a question, this is with regard to the P42 application, of whether there's an opportunity to write a program overview. And yes, the overview of the program, that description is called the program introduction. That is now 12 pages long. And I'm being asked, which one?
Well, if you're super fun, do you have to focus on one or more Superfunds?
Oh, okay, right. Okay, so we got a question from Tennessee of whether research activities have to focus on one or more Superfund sites, and we just really want to strongly reiterate that that is not the case. Corollary to that was do pet Superfund sites exist which we'll review more favorably? And no, the answer is no. There is no Superfund site requirement in this program. This is not a site-specific program. So we thanks for that question because we want to make sure that that point is very clear. Another question that came in is whether a DOE, Department of Energy, such as PNNL, can apply for SRP funding. And this is a question we get a lot. Due to our mandates, it must be university-based research, and so by university-based, it means the applicant, the PI, the program director, must come from a university, an accredited university of higher education.
Is this another question?
Yeah, and someone else asked about what do we mean by university-based. And there is actually a list of accredited U.S. universities. It is in the RFA.
So going back to the DOE question, we do allow you to come in to be part of a P42. So you could be a project, that could be a project within, but the PI, I mean the center director has to be at the university.
And in terms of federal labs, there are also lots of restrictions on, you know, what are allowable costs, and particularly with regard to salary. And so that's something that the institution itself needs to have worked out ahead of time with NIH. And we have to abide by all of those rules and regulations. Lisa, is that something that somebody could ask you for clarification later on?
Yeah.
Okay. So Lisa Edwards would be a good contact person for questions about federal partnering. And what's allowable.
Another question is, as a technical person, can someone please explain the term center that has been used in the presentation?
And I'm really glad we got that question because I did fail to mention that one big change in the P42 is that we're no longer calling them programs. They used to be called, well, they are a type of program grant. but we are now referring to them as centers. And I will yield to a colleague if there is a technical definition. And
all right. Technically speaking, center is in the P mechanism at NIH. Okay. It's a multi-project, but it's beyond just a PO1, more than just a program project grant. It has elements to it, as this one does, that incorporates training and research translation and other types of cores, as well as requirements for administrative programs. So it is a center in that definition from an NIH standpoint. I'm sure. Does that help, I hope?
Okay. Again, we'll give a chance for anybody on the phone to ask a question. If you're interested in asking questions, all you have to do is press *6, and it will unmute your phone line, and then you should be able to answer your question or ask your question. Okay. Is somebody trying to? Okay, we're going to go with a question for Dr. Allen.
Okay. This is a question from Cornell. What are the expectations with respect to preliminary data? I think you should just follow good general grantsmanship in this case. Of course, preliminary data always strengthens your application, but do remember that the preliminary data does fit into the research strategy, which has now been revamped and is under that 12-page limit. So we encourage if that preliminary data has been submitted, then of course you just list the publication. And I also want to caution you, I get comments from applicants all the time saying, oh, well, I'll just make my preliminary data really small and fit more in. Well, you've got to also remember that reviewers are reviewing these huge applications, and you don't want to make them frustrated or angry at trying to, you know, pull out a magnifying glass and read your figure legends, or blowing it up on their computer or by a Xerox machine. But with that said, you also cannot circumvent that 12-page limit by putting preliminary data or certain aspects of data in other non-page limited areas as well. So the short answer is follow good grantsmanship and be concise and just present exactly what you feel is needed.
So there was another question for Dr. Allen. Will the review committee include social scientists such as economists and political scientists?
Yes. If we make a very strong effort to include reviewers with the expertise that's presented in the applications. So if you have an application that requires that particular expertise, we certainly will. We will recruit them. Now, I also want to mention that about a month prior to the review, the review committee is available on the NIH website. And if you don't know how to view that committee, drop me an email and I'll send you the link to it. If you feel that there's no one on that committee who can review your application, then we are welcome to discuss in more detail what you feel is needed, and then we can add a reviewer at that point. But yes, whatever expertise is needed in your application, no matter if it's an expertise that's not part of the regular NIEHS purview, then we will get that expertise.
Thanks. So just want to let you know that we can go over and continue to answer questions, and we'll do that until we get kicked out of this room. So very quickly, I just wanted to answer a question. Mentioned that translation, this came from Florida, whether a translation should be addressed in each project. If this is part of the 12-page limit, if so, where should it go? If not, should it be in a separate section? And what we recommend is that on the each project in CORE, is able to have a one page that goes before the entire research summary or the research strategy that says its relation to the overall project. And we think that's a great place for a translational opportunity or a translation plan for a project to be mentioned. And of course, this would be repeated in the actual research translation core section as well. So that one page is not a part of the 12-page limit.
Mrs. Beth, I'd like to add that Heather made this point before. If you mention that you're working with, if you're a project and you're working with another project or you're working with another core, it's fine for you to state that in your project, but then the reciprocating core or project needs to also say the same thing. So you see consistency throughout your application. And so I would suggest that if you're having a translational activity in your project, that then in the core, at some point, it summarizes all the different translation that's going on within this application. So it looks like you're coordinated and communicating with each other. You all are in agreement what your partnering activities are internally.
Okay, again, let's let anybody from the phone line ask a question if they'd like to. Again, to do that, you press *6, and it will unmute your phone line.
Hello?
Yeah, hi.
Hi, yes, I'm calling from West Virginia University. I had a question about the community core.
Okay.
Yeah, so for new applications, is that expected to be a well-established partnership, or can it be in the initial stages?
For the community engagement for the core, I think that it can be established or it can be new. I think it's going to, it might be difficult to do a new group, and if you're working with an established group, you'll be maybe better positioned, but you aren't restricted to doing that. If you're going to working with an issue that no one's dealt with before, you might have to find and develop your own community, but that could be tricky.
Yeah, and I was, when you addressed this before, so are you looking for something that's really community-based, participatory research-oriented and written that way
for the project?
Not for the community engagement core, no, it's really not a community-based participatory research project.
Okay.
It's really working with the community. It's best if you have a well-established, but we know for new programs, this may be new territory. So if you've been working over the last several months in communications and developing a plan together of issues wanting to be tackled by the community, that's fine as long as you demonstrate that you've been working with them, that you're developing plans over the 5 years, they can become more sophisticated as you go along. You can have discuss ways that you're going to address continued needs or become more, develop additional materials as time goes on, but that should be laid out within your 12 pages.
Okay, thank you.
Is there another question on the call that was starting to come in?
Yeah, I have another question. So now we have a component for human genomics study. Specifically, we're interested in biomarkers. For example, biomarkers associated with heavy metals. And then to identify the set of biomarkers for early detection. For example, associated with heavy metal-induced lung cancer. And then we had this question. For this part, this genomics, if we put it as a core, as a genomic core, it is, when we write it up, it is still the format as a research project. Specifically, we have set up hypotheses and then specific games.
I don't know. That might be something we need to talk about more specifically. If you're talking about a specific project, we probably need like a paragraph or something to really make a better call on that. What you're describing sounds more like a research project than a core.
So in general, facility core should be for providing services to at least two or more projects.
Okay.
And they are not, and a facility core does not, quote, conduct research. There may be, because of needs within your center, that a facility core will need to develop and improve on technologies and approaches to assist the investigators in addressing their questions. That's okay.
Yeah, thank you. I think that explains a lot.
Okay, was there another question? Because I thought I heard it. Another question on the line? Okay, we do have a budget question. We want to make sure that Lisa can answer.
For Anthony at Cornell, for the budget category other, is there a resource that gives examples of allowed expenses? There is not, as far as I know, anything out there that actually gives a list of what can be used in this category. We often see things such as tuition, postage, if there's like service contracts for any equipment or anything that's being used or shared among programs. We see those costs there. We just ask that you submit it and justify it. If it's not allowed, then, you know, it'll be taken out. But if it's allowed and there's a good justification, then it's usually approved.
And Lisa, here's another question. Can a small business partner with or be a sub to a P42 multi-project center? That's from Newark, New Jersey.
It's yes for me, as long as there's no stipulation for the P42.
Yeah, we have no problem with that either. So the answer to that question is yes, a small business partner can be a sub for a P42 center.
Yes, yeah.
Okay, we're really going to have to wind down here. We'll allow maybe one more question on the phone. We welcome questions at any point in time, and there are a number of these questions that have come in electronically that we haven't gotten a chance to get to, but we will certainly post any that are very general interest. We will post those online, and any that appear to be kind of more private, and we'll just post that directly, we'll reply directly to you, and we should be able to do that in the next couple of days. I don't see any problem with that. There is one question that we get a lot about the RO1 program. This came from Detroit, Michigan. Does the institution have to have a P42 to submit an RO1? And the answer is no. You do not need to have a P42 in order to compete for this RO1 grant. Also, can a small business submit an SBIR proposal tailored to support a P42 multi-project center? And tailored to support? Any small business can support an SBIR proposal. In the past, there have been kind of weak connections to other researchers in a P42 multi-project center. It's certainly not a requirement, so you can interact, especially if you're doing an STTR, which often has a lot of university interactions. If that person happens to be part of a P42 center, you know, that's fine.
We'd very much like to see when we have a P42 for things coming out of the P42 to go into a small business in some sort of commercialization or application.
Okay. I do see one question that if we can touch on. It was about data sharing plans, and I think that the question was kind of vague. It says, what about data sharing plans in P42s? And I would like, if that person would like to
provide kind of a little more about what their question is specifically, then when we post the answers to the questions, we can go into a little more detail about that. Claudia, did you want to say something about that? Because that's something that everyone...
There's a very sort of minimal answer to that. Any grant that's over $500,000 has to have a data sharing plan. For the P42 centers at this point, we have suggested that there be data sharing plans that encompasses the entire program rather than project by project. That may change over time, but right now that's how it's described in the RFA. If you have any more specifics about that, please contact us offline. We can discuss it further.
Yeah, and I'd also say that a project or core is also welcome to include that in their own project or core description as well. There is a section for data sharing if that's appropriate to your project or core. Okay, so we're going to conclude. Thank you very much for everyone who has attended, to the SRP and NIEHS staff who have helped field some of these questions and prepared the presentation, and also to Justin Crane, who has been working behind the scenes to moderate this session. Again, this will be archived. It will be posted on the links that were provided on the last slide. And so I ask that there may have also been a slide that you could give your feedback, and so we encourage you to give us feedback. We will consider doing this again if you found it useful. And again, we will really seek to have these questions posted, by the end of this week. And we do think that the archive will be available within a month. So thanks again for everyone's attention. Bill, did you want to say any final words?
Well, I just want to say thank you all for being here. A lot of the questions, a lot of the responses that can be addressed, I encourage you all to look on our website. Everything that we do, everything that we try to do is on our website. It's available. I will also say that if you still have questions or you have questions, contact any one of us with regards to that at just about any time. I mean, there are holidays and evenings and we don't work. But we encourage you to look at this closely. We encourage you to participate in this very exciting program. And I want to thank you all for participating at the other end of the phone. I want to thank the staff around the table here for being in attendance and participating and being active here. Again, thank you very much.
All right. Goodbye, everybody.